This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Marjorie Cohn from the National Lawyers Guild talks about Dick Cheney's public confession that he ordered war crimes. On the Rendition Report, a lawyer with firsthand experience talks about the brutal conditions inside Guantanamo Bay Prison. We'll hear a report on the massive spill of toxic coal ash from the Tennessee Valley Authority. An Earth First organizer from Tennessee talks about the horrific practice of mountaintop removal coal mining. And the Night Report. Dennis Bernstein, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Amanda Bellerby are coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio from exile in New York City, The Night Report with Robert Knight.
In today's Night Report, a New Year's Eve trial for the reporter who voted with his feet, new allegations of torture are being met with arch rumors from the occupation prime minister, and a Turkish manufacturer says his bye-bye Bush shoes are flying off the shelf. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The Iraqi occupation regime announced today that the trial of Muntazir al-Zaidi, the journalist who voted with his feet against President Bush a week ago, will be prosecuted on New Year's Eve. The man whose airborne shoes catalyzed international opposition to 5 years of U.S. invasion, occupation, bloodshed, partition, and displacement in Iraq could face charges of, quote, aggression against a foreign head of state during an official visit, carrying a 5 to 15 year sentence, or a lesser charge of, quote, attempted aggression, quote, with a term of 1 to 5 years. But al-Zaidi is also contemplating torture litigation against the Green Zone government and the personal bodyguards of U.S.-installed Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who were among those assaulting him during the December 14th incident. Zaidi's attorney and his brother, Uday al-Zaidi, both repeated claims today that Muntazir had been beaten for 30 hours, struck with an iron bar and electrical cables, and suffered nude cold water torture, the loss of teeth, facial swelling, and cigarette burns behind his ears. Zaidi's family also denied official claims that he freely signed a letter requesting a pardon, quote, for the big and ugly act that I perpetrated, end quote, insisting that the journalistic patriot had expressed no such regret. In response, the U.S.-backed prime minister today escalated his own propaganda campaign against Zaidi, claiming on the Maliki website that, quote, he revealed that a person provoked him to commit this act, and that person is known to us for slitting throats, end quote. That allegation is also vigorously denied by al-Zaidi's family and defense team. Last week, Maliki also tried to link al-Zaidi to a pre-election purge of Sunni officials in the Interior and Defense Departments, whom the Maliki regime accused of plotting a coup with al-Zaidi's help, even though investigators have since backed off the coup allegations that were widely presented last week in the New York Times and elsewhere. As for the historic shoes, which occupation officials claim to have now destroyed, Uday al-Zaidi said his brother bought them at a used shoe bazaar in Cairo. As protests for al-Zaidi's release continued in Iraq and elsewhere, the incident has now produced its first inevitable product placement. A Turkey-based shoe company is insisting that it produce the magic black leather shoes that were hurled at President Bush. The Baydan company in Istanbul says orders for its shoes have stepped up so much that it's hired 100 extra workers to make 250,000 pairs of Model 271, now renamed the Bye Bye Bush shoe. Company President Ramazan Baydan said, quote, thanks to Bush, orders are flying in like crazy. We've even hired an agency to look at television advertising and, quote, no doubt, in hopes that the shoes will fly off the shelf. But, as yet, there's no word on the brand of socks that Muntazir al-Zaidi was wearing. And that's some of the news of this Monday, December 22nd, 2008. From exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
Thanks, Robert. I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The Obama administration is just about ready to take over the reins of power from Bush. The incoming president has already chosen his cabinet and sub-cabinet, for the most part, and announced a number of intentions and priorities. What Obama hasn't spoken much about is the fact that the outgoing administration seems to be guilty of major war crimes and crimes against humanity. And he hasn't said much about what he will do about it. Joining us to talk about this is Professor Marjorie Cohen. Cohen is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and the author of Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. She recently wrote the piece Cheney Throws Down Gauntlet, Defies Prosecution for War Crimes. Marjorie Cohen, welcome back to Flashpoints.
My pleasure, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. First of all, any rumblings from the Obama people about anything that looks like getting close to holding any of these people accountable for major war crimes, torture, illegal wars?
Well, during the campaign, Obama promised to promptly review these actions by the officials of the Bush administration to determine whether genuine crimes were committed. And Obama said, if crimes have been committed, they should be investigated. But he said, I would not want my first term consumed by what was perceived on the part of the Republicans as a partisan witch hunt, because I think we've got too many problems we've got to solve. Now, two advisors to the Obama campaign, during the campaign, told the Associated Press that there's little, if any, chance that his Justice Department will go after anyone involved in authorizing or carrying out interrogations that provoked worldwide outrage. So we don't know. Now, one sign I take as being somewhat hopeful is that not long ago, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, 12 retired generals met with President-elect Obama's top legal advisors, including his pick for Attorney General Eric Holder. And I spoke with one of those retired generals, actually a retired brigadier general, recently, who told me that Holder asked them if they thought he should prosecute. So the fact that Holder is seeking advice on that issue is, I think, a promising note. Biden, I understand, has recently said in response to questions about whether there would be prosecutions that he and Obama would focus on the future. I think that Obama would like to go forward and not be perceived as anything other than a uniter, not a divider.
Well, this is sort of the old boys network continuing. You know, the new president comes in and says, that's not our business. Torture, war crimes, Iran-Contra, whatever. We got to move on. But that is a very bad precedent to continue, isn't it?
It is a bad precedent, Dennis, because it says that high government officials of the United States government can get away with committing war crimes and with impunity. And it also says to the rest of the world that we're not going to hold these people accountable. You know, keep in mind that the former general counsel of the Navy, Alberto Mora, testified at the Senate Armed Services Committee in June that, and this is a quote from the former general counsel of the Navy, there are serving U.S. flag rank officers who maintain that the first and second identifiable causes of U.S. combat deaths in Iraq, as judged by their effectiveness in recruiting insurgent fighters into combat, are respectively the symbols of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And a former Special Intelligence Operations Officer, Matthew Alexander, agreed. He said that the number of Americans killed in Iraq because of the U.S. military's use of torture is over 3,000. So if you're talking about keeping us safe and you're talking about how America is perceived around the world, Obama should pay attention to what Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib have meant to our national security and what failing to prosecute these men for their offenses would look like.
Now, it's not only crimes committed, it's crimes admitted. Dick Cheney is rather proud of his part in setting up the whole structure of torture. You want to talk about that?
Yes. Well, Dick Cheney was asked on ABC News about waterboarding and colleague Sheikh Mohammed, and Cheney said, quote, I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared, unquote. And he says, yes, I think it was appropriate at the time. Now, U.S., the director of the CIA, Michael Hayden, has admitted that the CIA waterboarded at least three people. Waterboarding is, it's well known in U.S. law that waterboarding constitutes torture. And the U.S. War Crimes Act lists torture as a war crime, which is punishable by life imprisonment or even the death penalty if the victim dies. And so you might say, well, Cheney didn't, he didn't carry out the torture himself. Neither did Bush or Rumsfeld or Rice. But under the well-established doctrine of command responsibility, which is enshrined in U.S. law, commanders all the way up the chain of command to the commander-in-chief can be held liable for war crimes if they knew or should have known their subordinates would commit them and they did nothing to stop or prevent it. And here you have Cheney and other people admittedly in the White House, including Rice, Ashcroft, Powell, Rumsfeld, and George Tenet, planning and approving waterboarding. And Bush said he admitted approving of what they were approving of. So they've admitted it. We have memos by these lawyers from the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel by John Yoo, Jay Bybee, William Haynes, David Addington, authorizing the, basically telling the Bush administration that they're going to redefine torture so that whatever they do wouldn't constitute torture unless there's practically organ failure or near death, and immunizing them from prosecution for war crimes, setting up defenses which are not defenses to war crimes and torture, part of a common plan to violate our laws. And in fact, we have ratified two treaties, the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture. And by ratifying those, they become part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And they require that parties to those treaties bring perpetrators to justice, people who commit torture and cruel treatment. And if they don't bring them to justice, they have to extradite them to countries that will.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That is Marjorie Cohen. She is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, and she teaches at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Well, John Yoo, I mean, to follow this a little bit, if you don't hold them accountable, they continue to propagate their ideas, not only invent them and put them into place in the White House, but continue them by putting them in the minds of young people. Now, John Yoo, who wrote the legal justifications, who you alluded to, sort of left town here for a while. He's heading down in your direction. But again, if you do not hold these people accountable, they have a chance to continue to support this kind of war crime.
Yes, and Dennis, I know that, of course, you know that the National Lawyers Guild has called for the prosecution and dismissal of John Yoo from the University of California at Berkeley, which is one of the nation's premier law schools. And in response to our press release calling for that, the dean of the Berkeley Law School responded and said, well, he was not convinced that Yoo had committed crimes, but that if he had, that would be grounds for dismissal. There are some people who have raised the issue of academic freedom, that professors should be able to say anything they want in the classroom. And it's one thing to say things in the classroom. It's another thing to be hired by the President of the United States to come up with opinions and basically manipulate the law to facilitate the commission of war crimes. There's a real difference there. And in the opinion of the National Lawyers Guild, John Yoo and Jay Bybee, William Haynes, David Addington are war criminals, and they should be brought to justice.
And what do you think is the best way to at least hold Obama's feet to the fire? What do you suggest? How does this become an important issue in the context of a crumbling economy and, you know, some of the other things that are going on, ending the war, for instance?
Well, all of those things need to happen. Not that the economy should crumble, that the economy should be repaired, but certainly the war has to end immediately, the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. That's another conversation. But Obama should order his new attorney general to appoint an independent prosecutor to investigate and prosecute these people for war crimes. We used to have an independent counsel statute after Watergate. The Ethics in Government Act created the independent counsel statute. statute. But after Kenneth Starr used that independent counsel statute to go on a witch hunt against Bill Clinton, who, as we know, was impeached not for war crimes or torture or starting an illegal war, but for lying about sex under oath. And the Congress was, the backlash was that Congress allowed the independent counsel statute to expire of its own terms. And so now the power to appoint an independent prosecutor rests in the hands of the Attorney General. And of course, none of Bush's attorneys general, he's had three of them, would do anything that might implicate the Bush administration. So now it will be up to the new Attorney General in the Bush, in the Obama administration, to appoint an independent prosecutor. And it's important for us to pressure the Obama administration and the new Attorney General through letters and calls and emails and demonstrations, and say how important it is that these people be brought to justice, because we are a nation of laws where our Constitution is based on the rule of law, and the Constitution very clearly requires the president to faithfully execute the laws, and part of that is prosecuting lawbreakers.
Well, we only have 30 seconds left, but I guess the longer you wait, witnesses disappear, they get in plane crashes, all kinds of things happen to them. So I guess time is of the essence.
Yes, indeed. The sooner, the better.
All right, Marjorie Cohen, want to thank you very much. Professor Marjorie Cohen, she teaches at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, and she is the author of Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Dennis.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Nora Barrows-Friedman, and we continue with our new segment, The Rendition Report, with our special correspondent, Ahmed Gapour. Ahmed is a lawyer with the UK-based human rights organization Reprieve, and he represents clients being held in Guantanamo Bay torture prison and in secret prison sites around the world. Ahmed, it's great to have you back on with us again on Flashpoints.
It's great to be here, Nora.
So you're speaking to us from the East Coast, just back from another stay at Guantanamo. You saw some of your clients there. You worked on their cases. Let's talk a little bit about some of the items in the news to begin with. Over the weekend, Vice President Dick Cheney once again admitted that waterboarding has been used by the U.S. military and so-called intelligence sectors at Guantanamo and at other places. At the same time, the president-elect's advisors are saying that prosecuting the Bush administration officials for war crimes and their responsibility from torture that has happened during their tenure, all of that is pretty much off the table during the transition of administrations. Catch us up on what's going on in terms of the official line when it comes to torture, Bush policy, and the new administration as you just returned from Guantanamo.
Well, let's forget about the official line for a minute and talk about the real. It seems very apparent and absolutely true that Cheney did admit the use of torture in Guantanamo Bay. Now, if he's going far enough to say that we've waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and that he actually advocates and...
Cheney said, quote, "I signed off on it. Others did as well, too." And like you said, he names three so-called Al-Qaeda figures, Abu Zubaydah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and al-Nashiri. And then he says, that's it, those three guys. Do you think that waterboarding only happened to those three guys that Cheney talks about? You know, what's your response to what he's saying?
Absolutely not. I think many individuals currently being held at Guantanamo have been waterboarded. I think most of them have been tortured. What it comes down to these days is what the definition of torture is. I've got a client who's had razor blades taken to his genitals. I define that as torture. I've had another client who's had a refrigerator thrown at his face by an interrogator, calls himself King Kong. I also call that torture. I think being in solitary for longer than 30 days is torture. So it all comes down to what the definition is at the end of the day. The government takes the position that torture is something that doesn't exist. So I guess we don't torture, if you go by their definition.
And even if we do, it looks like the Obama administration has no plans to really prosecute those at the highest levels of command. So it doesn't even matter.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, they basically gave Cheney carte blanche to say what he said, and who knows what will come out in the future. But I'm very disappointed with the Obama administration's stance against prosecuting these guys.
That's the voice of our good friend Ahmed Gapour with Reprieve, a human rights organization based in London. He represents clients at Guantanamo and at other places around the world being rendered and tortured. Ahmed, another thing that's in the news is with all of this talk on the Obama administration considering closing Guantanamo, Germany has said that it would take in some of the foreign detainees who have been held and detained and tortured at Guantanamo. The government spokesperson for Germany said, quote, "In our view, Guantanamo must be closed on legal and humanitarian grounds in terms of international law and human rights and for moral reasons." And he said that it was the responsibility of the U.S. to find a new residence for inmates it did not want to accept or who could not be returned to their home countries. Al Jazeera is reporting this. You know, what is the legal obligation for the United States as they have rendered people to Guantanamo and elsewhere around the world, had them tortured, and then once Guantanamo closes, where do these people go?
Well, the legal obligation is that the Geneva Convention forbids the rendering of somebody to a country where they will be tortured. Now, this is something the U.S. has done for years. There's a report called Torture by Proxy that came out by the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at NYU Law. That was actually the first thing I worked at, worked on as a law student. And so that practice is well documented. As far as the obligation of these European countries, they actually don't have an obligation to take anyone. But what we found is, you know, a lot of these places that are beginning to pop up and inviting former prisoners to come and stay to host them in their countries, a lot of these countries have actually colluded with the United States, whether it be allowing flights to pass over their airspace or keeping people in prison before they've been to Guantanamo and other prisons. So I think it's a very positive sign that these European countries are bucking up and basically stepping up and trying to right their past wrongs.
And Ahmed, though a few prisoners have been trickling out of Guantanamo, coming back to their home countries over the past few weeks and months, how many prisoners are still being held inside Guantanamo at this point?
Over 270.
And what about their legal status? What can you say? What are the statistics and data that you've been collecting about
their
legal
status?
Well,
they basically fall into three major groups. There's a group of cleared prisoners. And within that group, there's a group of cleared prisoners and non-cleared prisoners who actually cannot be repatriated to their home countries because they will be indefinitely detained and tortured. These are countries like Tunisia, Syria, Libya, and in Morocco, Algeria as well. And for these individuals, we've actually got TRO motions in place in court that's actually preventing them from going home. There's another group that...
What's TRO stand for?
I'm sorry? A temporary restraining order. Sort of like an injunction in court barring the military from transferring these guys. This, of course, has not stopped the military from putting them through transfer proceedings, but at least it gives us a heads up so that we could follow up in court and prevent the actual transfer. The other group is a group of people that the Obama administration and the current administration says that they'll want to try. And that's where the mix-up happens. That's where the room for creativity is. And so you've got several different proposals on the playing field. And one of them is that we'll create these special, what I call kangaroo courts in the United States and special detention facilities, special national security courts, because we can't allow these guys to be tried in district court. Now, the actual fact of the matter is that there have been nearly 100 terrorism cases tried in district court since September 11th, and there's not been one breach of national security. So my question to the Obama administration, my question to the current administration is, what's the big deal? What's the foot dragging? And why are there rumors about legislation being proposed to fix this problem when it could be fixed basically in the first month of your tenure?
How do you think that could be fixed? I mean, like, what are the proceedings? What's the structure that lawyers and human rights organizations are looking at? I mean, where does the responsibility lie? What kind of structure are you hoping that Obama will take to close it down?
I'm hoping he will resettle all those that can't go back to their countries. And I'm hoping he'll work with other countries such as Yemen, who are waiting to accept over 70 prisoners. And I'm hoping with the remaining 50 or so that he plans on trying, that he'll bring them over to U.S. soil and treat them just like any other prisoner. That's the right thing to do. And that's the quickest way that we'll end this whole process.
And what about the space itself? What about Guantanamo Bay Prison as a complex, as a place in Cuba? You know, what are Cubans saying? What is the community surrounding Guantanamo saying about how this prison complex impacts them?
Well, as you know, Nora, I'm actually not allowed in Cuba. I only go to the naval base and then come back home to the United States. So I don't have access to Cubans in terms of actual Cuban nationals living in Cuba. However, there are several Cubans working on the island. There are several Jamaicans working on the island. There are several Filipinos working on the island. And that's a completely different issue. These individuals are getting paid anywhere between 87 cents and $2.20. It's actually a shame that our military utilizes indentured servitude.
My God. So these people are being paid by the U.S. Navy base or the military? Or?
It's my understanding that the naval base actually has a subcontractor called Bremcor, and they are the ones that get these foreign nationals to sign contracts, bring them over, and it's only then that they realize how much they're being duped for. They can't get out of their contracts because they have to pay their way home, and sometimes that costs up to $2,000, especially if you're getting out to the Philippines.
Wow, well, that's a separate issue in itself. Definitely we'll have to follow up on that. That's the voice of our friend Ahmed Gapur, a lawyer with Reprieve. He just came back from Guantanamo Bay Prison, and he's talking about his experiences there and those of his clients. What are your clients going through on a daily basis in Guantanamo? What about the freedom of religion? You know, how much access do they have to sunlight, the outside, or communication with their families and their attorneys?
Well, most people get about a phone call. What we've seen is about a phone call a year. There's word that they may increase the number of calls to 2 or 3 per year. In terms of religious freedom, they each get a Quran and a book of tafsir, which is basically a commentary on the Quran. I myself was in a meeting with one of my clients, and I was prevented from praying with him. When I asked why, the guard told me that for activities such as using the lavatory and prayer, the attorney must step out of the meeting room. I found it kind of interesting that they lumped in using the lavatory and prayer, especially given the context of what the U.S. soldiers used to do to Qurans back in the day before it was exposed, which was literally take a Quran and stick it in a big bucket of feces right in front of the detainees.
And is there any indication that that practice could still be going on?
There's no indication that I've heard of. But there are several abuses that are going on every single day. Their walks, for example, they only get 30 minutes to 2 hours, depending on which camp, what discipline level you're in, of walking time. Otherwise, they spend most of their time, most of the guys in the more maximum security camps spend the bulk of their day in solitary confinement. They have no communication to the outside world. They have lights on them 24 hours a day. Many of my guys have gotten horrible eye illnesses as a result, not to mention the fact that the frequency of really, really bright fluorescent lights over a 7-year period will do catastrophic things to your psyche. Oh, it gets worse.
Tell us more. Maybe talking about what it does to your psyche. I mean, what does 7 years of compounded, ongoing torture, humiliation, and psychological trauma, what does that do to people? And not just your clients, but what about the families of those people, the communities
exactly.
In which they live?
They've torn a lot of families apart. These guys have basically had no communication to the outside world. Any news that they get is heavily censored. It comes in late. They're in a constant state of disorientation. If not internal, then imposed from the outside. They're constantly disrespected by the guards. I have reason to believe that several of my clients are clinically psychotic or clinically insane or just clinically depressed or suffering from bipolar disorder, the gamut, basically. And you can't really blame them.
No, you can't. I mean, just spending a few days there, here and there for you, has also been quite an experience, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's quite a depressing place. everything about it is depressing.
Well, finally, Ahmed, your boss, Clive Stafford Smith, who is the director of Reprieve, he's also the lawyer for Binyam Muhammad, who we spoke about last month when we did this segment, a young British resident who has been held at Guantanamo Bay and rendered a few times now. Clive Stafford Smith has accused Robert Gates, the U.S. Defense Secretary, who is going to be continuing his post throughout the new administration, of signing a, quote, flagrantly false affidavit to avoid having to disclose evidence of torture in the case of Binyam Muhammad. How is Reprieve following up on this, and what could this mean in terms of repercussions for the Obama administration and Robert Gates in particular?
Well, if he's flagrantly signed, if he's basically lied in front of a court, then he's guilty of perjury. I think that consequences for him, aside from public shame, could actually be his removal from office. And we're basically trying to follow up with that at the moment, and trying to figure out if it was just a misunderstanding on Gates's part or if he actually had knowledge of particular documents that put my client in Morocco getting tortured 2 years well before he ever entered Guantanamo. That's something that we'll have to wait and see on.
Definitely. And before we let you go, Ahmed, you're a young, newly credentialed lawyer. You jumped right into this really intense, exhausting work representing people who the world has completely forgotten about, it seems. Why did you take this job in this realm of legal representation? As I'm sure many of your cohorts in law school went on to do corporate litigation, you know, et cetera. Why did you do this?
The notion of due process itself is why I defend these guys, because they've been imprisoned for 7 years without a single charge. It's the absolute, the most horrific thing I can imagine, what goes on in their heads. And now that we're actually pursuing litigation on their behalf, we're not even allowed to tell them what allegations they're up against. We're not allowed to show them the evidence that has been presented against them. Everything is secret. As one of my clients has told me, and this is based on unclassified notes that I've had cleared, I can understand you having secret evidence against me. But if the allegation is also secret, I'm not really sure how I can respond to that. I'm not sure how I can defend myself. I'm basically put in a position where my hands are tied, and they've been tied for the past 7 years. And where is the justice, right? Where is what the United States of America claims that it stands for?
All right. Well, we are really glad that you're here with us doing this incredibly important segment called The Rendition Report. We're going to keep following your journeys across the world and back inside Guantanamo and out. That's the voice of Ahmed Gapour. He's a lawyer working with Reprieve. And Ahmed, where can people go to learn more about Reprieve's work and the work that you do?
You can go to www.reprieve.org.uk and learn all about it. And please make a donation, because we just lost a lot of funding.
Thank you so much, Ahmed, and please be safe.
Thank you, Nora.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Greenpeace today called for a criminal investigation into the failure of the Tennessee Valley Authority to prevent the spill of more than 500 million gallons of coal ash sludge into the Emory River, a tributary of the Clinch and Tennessee Rivers. The spill followed the breach of a dike at a coal-fired power plant owned by the TVA and covered as many as 400 acres of land with potentially toxic ash as high as 6 feet deep. Joining us to talk about the situation and the dangers is Rick Hind. Rick Hind is a Greenpeace legislative director. Rick, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having us.
Well, it's good to have you with us. It's a very terrible situation. Please describe as best as you can how bad it is. What does it look like on the ground?
Well, I think that I have not been there, but from reading all of the accounts of it, it looks like a small volcanic mudslide that has, covered not only part of the community, but of course, killing parts of the river and threatening downstream rivers as well. And all the while, you know, the plant is now still operating. So it's really it's outrageous. And probably the most outrageous thing about it is, or equally, is that it was all preventable. This is the kind of thing that In fact, under the Clean Water Act, it is a crime, a criminal offense, to fail to have a contingency plan to prevent this kind of spill.
All right.
So we hope an investigation will reveal who and if there are responsible parties for this, and maybe that will have some of a motivation to make sure it doesn't happen again. But, of course, the best prevention would have been clean energy.
Now, describe exactly what we're talking about when we talk about this toxic coal ash sludge. What is it?
Well, when you burn coal for electricity, which is the largest source of our electricity in the United States, is burning coal the way we did in the 19th century, you get the majority of that is still left behind as ash, and it still contains a lot of the contaminants like mercury, cadmium, and other heavy metals. And so they had this sludge in what you might call a settling pond or lagoon, and which then broke loose early Monday and flooded the community and the river. And it is the kind of thing that, like I said, there's criminal sanctions for not having an adequate plan to prevent that kind of spill, because that kind of technology is inherently dangerous, inherently poses that risk every day it's operating.
500 million gallons of coal ash sludge. How does that compare with previous spills? How widespread is this? How many people could be affected by this?
Well, it's still not over. This is all going to go down wherever it goes in the river, under the water. It'll be running off from the land as rain and weather occurs. So really, it's an ongoing contamination and disaster. And the community there really, our heart goes out to them because they have to deal with this in holiday time. When, they obviously rather be celebrating with their families. I think the full extent of the damage is yet to be understood. And we're glad to hear that multiple agencies are on the scene, not only to help with the cleanup, but to assess the damage.
How significant are the Clinch and Tennessee rivers in this context? What do people need them for? What are they counted on for? How could this affect daily life?
Well, I'm sure this could affect everything from fishing to people's recreation. Not far from there, there's a huge wildlife management area, and then down the river is Knoxville. So anything from potential drinking water sources to recreation to anyone who is subsistence fisher, people who rely on that food as part of their diet, economically or culturally. So it's really, somebody else's business, namely dirty electrical generation through coal, is taking away everyone else's business, you might say, to operate in this area. And again, we've got to remember the lesson here. It's the most important thing we can take away from this is how to prevent it in the future. And the way to do that is just imagine, would this have happened with windmills? Would this have happened with a solar energy complex? No. None of that would have been possible. Why weren't there measures taken to prevent this kind of dike from breaking? That's a criminal offense potentially under the Clean Water Act. So you look at the Bush administration, they've resisted regulating coal ash. They walked away from the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty, which would have us moving to cleaner energy 8 years ago. So we've really lost a lot of time, and this kind of disaster could be in our future in other communities around the country unless we accelerate the move toward cleaner renewable energy.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about a spill that may be bigger than the one that came out of the Exxon Valdez in Tennessee under the authority of the Tennessee Valley Authority. And we are following, I guess, the various implications of what this could mean. Now, we hear the president-elect Obama. We heard his opponents talking about clean coal. But isn't the processes, the modern processes of getting coal, i.e. blowing the tops of mountains off, creating these sludge ponds at high levels on the what's left of the mountain, aren't these the new dangers of this kind of gathering of coal?
Very good point. Every stage of the life cycle of coal is dirty, damaging to the environment, and some of that damage could be irreversible. So that's right. We're seeing runaway mountain topping to extract coal, and then, of course, burning it in power plants, and then living with these kinds of consequences, whether in this case it's a very dramatic disaster, or the slow disaster of lung disease and contamination in the air, and the gradual disaster of climate change, of extreme weather events. Somebody said, well, this is a result of heavy rain. Well, what do you think climate change is going to bring us? You know, this is a kind of almost, you might say, a self-destructive, suicidal policy to stay addicted to coal. Fortunately, the safe technologies are there, and within 20 or 30 years, we could be moving to them entirely and beginning to close down all of the coal plants that pose these kinds of inevitable risk.
Rick, I heard from some environmentalists, correct me if I'm wrong, that they actually use tons of dynamite. They've used more, the equivalent of more dynamite than the Hiroshima bomb to blow the tops of these mountains off. The actual use of the dynamite is dangerous. It causes destruction of the environment around the mountain. And so the dangers are multiple, and now we're seeing the other side of so-called clean coal.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I think by definition that it's more power than those weapons, because you're talking about the energy it takes. Just imagine the energy it takes to displace an entire mountain. And then on top of that, as you point out, there's tremendous amount of erosion and contamination from extracting all the coal from the mountain. And so, you know, instead of the pretty picture they tried to show you many years after it's been removed and they plant something on top of it, they've ruined an ecosystem. They've ruined unique wildlife and vegetation and other forms of life that are irreplaceable in that area. And in many cases also ruined people's businesses that were set up around there. So we just see that, you know, somebody with big money, in this case King Coal, is able to determine what gets done with people's land, and in this case then what has happened takes away their water. Add to that the pollution of the air and climate. What else can you take from us? Our air, our water, and our children's future. And so it's really important we learn the lesson here and not forget these people as another victim, really, of the addiction to fossil fuels.
And finally, we talk about, and as I said, President-elect Obama uses the phrase quite frequently, clean coal. We've got a new energy secretary. Coal is still in the mix. What's the message for the president?
Well, we think that the president has, you know, would like to have his cake and eat it too, and we all would, or the new president, that is. But to at least, I think, keep the best scenario open, I think that what we see is the investment that they propose making in clean technologies like solar, wind, and other truly renewable clean energy, that should pay off and show the administration that clean coal, so-called clean coal, which is really an unproven technology, is not worth taxpayer money. It's not worth either the money or the time wasted in pursuing it while we need to catch up quickly in terms of these greenhouse gas reductions. Same thing with nuclear. So we hope that the competition with clean energy will show that coal and nuclear really have nothing great to offer in solving our energy needs, and they certainly don't help our the problem with climate. And nuclear is in the same boat, because with nuclear you still engage in a lot of wasted energy extracting uranium, and then you have other risks such as weapons proliferation and nuclear accident risks. And if Wall Street won't fund nuclear, why should the public?
Any hope with Stephen Chu, the new energy person? He's actually done a lot of work and supported the recycling of depleted uranium for weapons.
Well, the good news is that everyone gets the science and the urgency of catastrophic climate change. And so they understand that. And if they do understand that, they know that we don't have time to gamble on these unproven technologies, that we need to truly invest in almost all of our time and money into these cleaner green energies. And if those people listening communicate that, I think the one thing that President-elect has said over and over is that change doesn't happen in Washington, it happens from outside Washington. So that if people engage and get involved here, I think we can convince the policymakers and Congress that clean coal and nuclear are a waste of our time and money, and in fact steal from us the very time and money we need to focus on preventing more climate change, but also having a sustainable energy future, one that is independent of foreign fossil fuels, one that has stable price structures, and that allows the economy to grow without making the earth or public health at risk.
All right. We have been speaking with Rick Hind. He is the Greenpeace Legislative Director. We've been talking about a massive spill took place under the authority of the Tennessee Valley Group, TVA, 500 million gallons of coal ash sludge into the Emory River, a tributary of the Clinch and Tennessee Rivers. We're going to watch this very closely. We thank you, sir, for the good information.
Thank you. Great talking with you.
Coal trains run through our veins, moving monuments to better days. That mountain stands over our darkened lungs. It's time to ponder what we've become. In his company town, it's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, the tower goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town. Yankee bosses worked us so hard for their well-dressed children and their well-kept yards, while coal camps echoed with the mournful sounds of impoverished voices from deep in the ground. Under this company town is what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town. Our parents' memories of World War II, minds worked round the clock, was the American thing to do. Families gathered round their radios to hear FDR say we'd make it somehow in our town.
The region known as Appalachia is one of the most beautiful and biologically diverse on Earth. The mountains and forests of Appalachia filter air and water, create soil, provide habitat and sanctuary for humans and non-humans alike. One of the greatest environmental and human rights catastrophes in recent American history is now underway in this bioregion, just southwest of Washington, D.C. In the coal fields of Appalachia, entire communities are being driven off their land by flooding, landslides, and blasting resulting from mountaintop removal. In the coal industry's zeal for quick profits and cheap electricity, miners' jobs are being replaced by machines, and beautiful mountains and streams are being destroyed forever. Joining me on the phone from Knoxville, Tennessee, is John Johnson, veteran organizer and activist with Kitua Earth First. John, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thanks.
First of all, can you talk about these mountains and forests and describe what your part of Appalachia looks like?
The mountains of Appalachia are some of the oldest and most biologically diverse temperate forests on the planet. One of the more prominent forest types in particular covers the coal field part of Appalachia. It's called a mixed mesophytic forest, and some ecologists theorize that this forest is actually the kind of evolutionary mother forest of all the hardwood forests in the east. The mountains and the coal fields tend to be super steep. Most of them are part of the greater Appalachian Plateau, which is kind of the western part of Appalachia. Most of it actually no longer resembles a plateau because it's cut by so many creeks, streams, and rivers.
Has it been heavily logged in history? Are there really old trees there?
Well, of course, the biological diversity has been severely impacted by historical logging, coal mining, and the effects of the ongoing globalization and exchange of critters. We've lost and are losing several of our keystone species because of imported pests and exotics due to the globalization and homogenization of the world economy. But the forest remains very biologically diverse, and it remains crucial to our life here. The forest is very important in filtering water and slowing down rain. It is important in filtering air, and over millennia, it's created the soil that is the basis for our agriculture.
When we talk about coal mining, most of us probably think of movies we've seen with the miners coming up from underground covered in black coal dust. What is different about this mountaintop removal?
Okay, so mountaintop removal is just what the name implies. With big machines and millions of tons of explosives, they blow the tops off the mountains. It's this layer of sandstone, and there's seams of coal in there, so they blow off the top layer, and then they push the rubble, you know, what used to be a forest, and the blown-up rock, and slate, and shale, and dirt, and clay, and all this other stuff, and they just push it down into the valleys, generally at the tops of the hollers, but basically at the tops of the watersheds, and then they keep doing that until all the coal is gone.
And what's left behind?
And
what does it look like?
It's a barren wasteland. The coal industry paints themselves as these kind of conquering heroes, like they're coming in to flatten this land that these poor people have inherited that's too steep to do anything useful with, economically speaking. But the reality is that less than 5% of the area that they've destroyed has actually been reclaimed to use for any economic development.
So you're saying it goes from being this steep mountainous area to completely flat so that they can develop it, supposedly?
Yeah. Something like 1,200 miles of streams in Appalachia have been buried with these valley fills, and something on the order of 500 square miles have been destroyed.
What does this do to the watersheds?
Basically, the valley fills are covering up the streams, and because they've stripped off the timber, there is no intact forest left to slow down the rain. And so there's been this dramatic increase in flash flooding, particularly in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. You know, these valley fills are just piles of rubble in the valley, and so the water just hits it and runs off, and there's landslides and mudslides, just, you know, walls of water going down through the hollows and thrashing people's homes and cars and pets and, you know, livestock, and the communities are being torn apart. If not from the flooding, then from the social tension of the folks who are still working for the coal industry and actually engaged in mountaintop removal, and folks who live there, who value their homes and their independent mountaineer culture, and then they're watching it be destroyed. And it's also important to note that the coal companies actually stole a lot of this land. You know, they were dealing with mountain people, many of whom did not necessarily have a you know, a literate education. It's not to say that they were dumb, they just didn't know how to read and write, and so they were often cheated out of their land as the coal and timber barons forced the cash economy into the region. Appalachia, realistically, is basically a third world resource colony for the rest of America. You know, there's definitely a few places that are poorer and just as neglected or abused, but in terms of just straight up resource exploitation, this is it.
How big an area are we talking about that is now being threatened in Tennessee?
There's a company named National Coal that has started up here in Knoxville that has just recently been purchasing either the surface rights and or the mineral rights to over 100,000 acres in the coal fields of the Cumberland Mountains of East Tennessee, just to the north and west of Knoxville. One of the first things they did was they purchased what we think is the first mountaintop removal project in Tennessee on a mountain called Zeb Mountain above a lovely little community called Elk Valley. We're really afraid that because of the, I hate to call it a success, but for the coal companies, it's been a very successful program of mountaintop removal in eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, that this is now going to start to happen in Tennessee.
What about the industry's claim that this creates jobs?
Well, your listeners who have been familiar with the timber wars of the Pacific Northwest will recognize a familiar scenario. They claim that they're protecting jobs and creating jobs, but the reality is that employment in the coal mining industry has been declining steadily since the 50s and 60s, while the tonnage of coal produced has been increasing. And that is simply due to the fact that they use big machines instead of men, and they're using explosives. One of my buddies, one of my co-organizers in Ketua Earth First, is saying dynamite's a lot cheaper than people. And what's happening is our bioregion, southern and central Appalachia, is being turned into this national sacrifice zone so that everybody else can use, you know, hair dryers and play video games and all this useless stuff that modern culture promotes that is really just a waste of electricity. Our forests and mountains are indeed the most biologically diverse temperate forests on the planet, and to wreck that so that we can have video games and televisions on all night is really pathetic. And of course, you know, my larger vision is that we actually someday succeed in toppling the resource extraction oligarchy that grips this country, and that we actually overthrow that oligarchy and create a truly free and environmentally sound culture here in Appalachia and across the rest of Turtle Island and across the planet. We have a website that is www.mountainjusticesummer.org.
And that was John Johnson from Knoxville, Tennessee, and Ketua Earth First. John, thank you for joining us today on Flashpoints.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
In Berkeley, reporting for Flashpoints, this is Amanda Bellerby. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.